muscle and blood and skin and bone. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load
16 tons. What are you getting? Another day older and deeper in debt. Saying you feel it on to call me, call. I can't go.
Oh, my soul to the company store. Bless his soul, he loaded
16 tons, and what did he get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Sang feeling on to call me, call. I can't go.
Oh, my soul to the company store. You then the left one will you load
16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, call. I can't go.
Oh, my soul to the company store.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner and welcome. Good to have you all with us today here on this Labor Day. And we're going to celebrate Labor Day here on the Mark Steiner Show by talking with people who are involved in unions, people who are involved as workers on the front line organizing unions, reflect on what this Labor Day means, about why labor has shrunk so drastically when there was from a high, let's say, in private sector workers in the 50s of almost 35% down to almost 6% of workers now in the private sector organized. What's the cause of that? Is it Taft-Hartley? We'll look at that. Is it the bureaucratization of labor unions? Is it globalization? What about the issue of race and how it divides unions in America? How does that play into it all? And more. We are joined here in studio. And we'll do a little celebration. We'll be hearing labor songs, really cool labor songs, during the course of our conversation with our guests. Bill Barry is with us, who's retired director of labor studies at the Community College of Baltimore County. It was in Dundalk. He's author of Union Strategies for Hard Times and the book From First Contact to First Contract, a Union Organizer's Handbook, coming out with a new book on the 1877 Baltimore Railroad Strike. Corey McCray is with us, who is an organizer for his local union, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW. He's a small business owner and co-founder of the Best Democratic Club and is running for the House of Delegates, I might add.
Great to be here.
Good to see you again, Corey. Jasmine Jones is with us. She's a server and union leader at Duke Law, operated by Aero Services Group at BWI Airport. Jasmine, great to meet you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. And Mike Hatchie is with us. Mike Hatchie is an organizer for Unite here, Local 7, which is one of the organizers of the workers at the airport. Good to have you in the studio as well.
Thank you for having me.
Happy Labor Day to everybody. Good to have
Happy
you
Labor
all
Day.
Here.
Happy Labor Day.
So let me just begin, because we talked about this before we went on the air for a moment, Bill. As a labor historian, among many other things that you do, talk about the history of Labor Day. What is this day? I mean, because I'm managed to confuse by it. We think it's the kind of American substitution for May 1st, the International Labor Day. What is this day?
Well, in some ways it was a substitution for May. Some ways it was a substitution for May 1st. The union movement, as we talked about briefly, the 1877 railroad strike involved hundreds of thousands of workers, brutally defeated. But the union movement continued. And in 1882, in the spring, the workers in New York City and all the different unions, and there were competing visions of how unions should be organized. There were the craft unions, and the craft unions became part of the American Federation of Labor. And they said people need to organize on the basis of common skills, and exactly the way Corey's union is organized. They're all electricians. The other union, the Knights of Labor, said workers should organize an industrial basis, that all workers for a common employer should be in the same union. And the Knights of Labor were a much more radical political group. They believed in their own political parties, the cooperative commonwealth, things like that. But they were fighting for union recognition, existence of unions, and an issue which is sadly neglected, and that is a shorter work day. And one of the things I always talk to people about is that the 8-hour day became an official policy in the 1880s. We're still at it. And that's not progress. I think one of the things about Labor Day...
We're still at it, you mean? We're still at the 8-hour day?
Still 8-hour day. Gotcha, it's considered a normal work day.
Right, right.
And I think one of the things that we've seen in the last week after the March on Washington and the little pep rally on Wednesday is that people start to think, where have we gone in 50 years? Have we achieved what we want to achieve or not? And if not, what do we have to do different in the future to get there?
So where did this
So what they did was the Labor Council in New York City, which was an amalgam of all the unions, got together and said, we need to have a rally for the shorter work day. And we're going to do it in September. Some unions, radical unions, many of them with European refugees, still celebrated May Day. And May Day has historically been a revolutionary union day. And the workers of New York said, well, we're going to have our own parade. And they set the second Tuesday in September as the date, and they marched. And at first they were worried nobody was going to show up. And then the Jewelers Union from New Jersey came across on the ferry, and they had a band, and it was an estimated about 10,000 people. And what it then continued, and then some states started legislating for Labor Day, making an official holiday. And in 1894, the federal government finally did in June. And it's ironic because exactly at the same day that Congress passed the law making Labor Day a federal holiday, the federal government under Grover Cleveland intervened in the Pullman strike, which started at exactly the same time. It was a massive strike by the new American Railroad Union led by Eugene Debs. And the federal government came in with legal injunctions to stop the strike and with military force, as they did here in Baltimore during the 1877 B&O strike. So just at the time Labor Day becomes announced. And so since then, often people will say, well, it's a captive Labor Day. You know, it's not a true holiday that the workers took. But ever since then, it's been the first Monday in September. Most union members haven't got a clue of what it is. It's just another paid holiday. And it's really sad because people always complain about how holidays that are designed to commemorate certain events lose their meaning in the blur of shopping and barbecues and beer and all kinds of stuff that people do on a holiday.
Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and a drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me want go home.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Day is a day.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Day is a day, is a day, is a day.
Daylight come and me want go home.
A beautiful bunch, a ripe banana.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Hide the deadly black tarantula.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Live
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
come and we want to go home. 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and we want to go home.
There is a day, oh.
Daylight come and we want to go home.
There is a day. Is a day, is a day,
is a day, is a day.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight, come and we want to go home.
Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana.
Daylight, come and we want to go home.
Day, oh, day, oh.
Daylight, come and we want to go home.
Day.
So a broad question for us, really from all of you. Everybody here is a union member or been involved in unions, and some people argue, especially on the business side of the world, that unions are dead. There is no power left. That they've shrunk to such a point that they are almost meaningless. They can't flex their muscle. They can't force the Obama administration or any other administration to do what they want. They have no influence on the Hill. They have no influence in the communities anymore. That the organizations are just dormant for lots of reasons. Do you feel the unions are dormant? Are they dormant?
I would say no. I would say that we've lost as much power as we had. Maybe when Professor Barry, you know, maybe the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, but I would say, is it dormant? No, I think that it's still powerful unions such as SEIU. I think the AFSCME is pretty strong. I think that in reference to the building trades, you would say that the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers is one of the strongest. But just going back to what he stated in reference to Labor Day, I really enjoy Labor Day. I think that the reality is that my generation, I think that it's definitely a generational thing, and that we didn't have to go through many trials and tribulations in the workplace, but we're going through them now. As we see, we didn't have to go through them that they had in the 30s and the 40s and some when they started to get pretty good for workers. Some people look at it as a day off. Some people look at it as an extra paid holiday if they do go to work. But some people do, if you know the history of it, you understand that we're celebrating the benefits. We're celebrating the accomplishments that were made before our generation and try to build on that. But with the ever-increasing challenges of workers, their pensions going to 401ks, working more hours before whether it's 410s or whether it's 312s instead of having a set 8-hour day before achieving overtime, whether it's some of the things that are basically the core principles of a worker, working, having the weekends off. We find ourselves working the weekends a lot now. Some of the core principles, and as those principles diminish, I think that the labor movement is going to become stronger. I bounce around from Ohio, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. working on different campaigns. So I get to see firsthand some of the conditions that's being torn down and being able to explain or see workers that's fed up and say, I'm not going to deal with it anymore. We're entering into it with the fast food workers. We're entering into it with the Walmart workers. So we see so many challenges that's coming about us at a quick rate, but it's starting to explode right in front of our face. Is it exploding fast enough? I'm not sure, but it's definitely happening.
How do you feel as a young worker who has happened to organize a union?
I feel like there is a lot of power behind a union. There's a lot of people who don't understand what the power is. But in the same token, I work with these people on a regular basis. They're upset about their checks. They're upset about not having overtime. They're upset about you not being able to have money to fall back on. And in the restaurant industry alone, you know, everybody says, oh, well, you know, you can find another job. You know, it's just a restaurant. It's just, you know, something that, you know, you can go and find something else. But some of my coworkers have kids. So who is there to protect them? The union is supposed to be there to protect them. And I feel like it can be power if we're all together. I feel like if there's a togetherness, then, you know, of course it'll be powerful. And I'm honestly saying it with my own two eyes that, yes, the union is very powerful.
Were you in a union before you took this job?
No.
You were just working in the restaurant, right?
Both my parents were in unions.
Both your parents were in unions?
Yes.
So what unions were they in?
My father works for the city. He's in the city union.
Uh-huh.
And my mother was in the nursing union.
Did you feel that when you walked through the door, or is something union came to you because of the conditions you found?
I mean, when I walked into my job, I knew it wasn't right. A few of my coworkers, we wanted to start a union. Like, we wanted a union because we knew that our work conditions weren't right. They weren't up to par. You know, you come into work, you do your eight, you know, it should be nothing extra. It shouldn't be anything that you don't want to do. You shouldn't be forced to do things that you don't want to do. And we all looked at each other, and I'm like, okay, something has got to give, you know. And I start talking to my dad and my uncles, and they're like, yeah, you guys should get a union, you know. And so we're looking for unions, and they came knocking on my door.
Unite here.
Yes.
Which is who you represent.
Yes.
So, I mean, so your same thought about whether we're at a point where unions are powerless.
Absolutely not. I think that every time workers come together and stand up and fight, the labor movement is alive. And I think it's really worth remembering that just a few years ago, it seemed impossible to take on Walmart. It seemed impossible to take on McDonald's. And I heard over and over again, these are the problems of the labor movement that are unsolvable. We can't get workers together in retail or fast food jobs. And those are the exact places now where workers are standing up and fighting. And I think labor is always at its best when we see ourselves as part of a broader movement. And that's what Unite Here Local 7 is trying to be a part of in Baltimore, as a broader movement for fair development in the city, not just fighting one workplace at a time. In the situation that we're in 2013, the deck is so stacked against workers that I think it has to be bigger than any one fight at a time. And that's why when workers stand up at the airport, when workers stand up in the Inner Harbor, we're seeking to ally with other community groups like United Workers, Community Churches United, and have a real fighting voice for working people in this debate about development that's happening in Baltimore. That working people must be a part of that debate, and we see it now. The development debate in Harbor Point was different because people showed up, spoke out. So I wouldn't call the labor movement dead by a long shot.
I guess I'm just not as optimistic, and I think all of the things that the three of them have talked about are great. I think you have to look realistically at the facts, and I think, Mark, what you mentioned is that there is not much political influence. I didn't see a significant change in the debate over the harbor issues. I saw one council person kind of stand up and object to it, but the rest of them rubber stamped it and it went right on through. And as a taxpayer in the city of Baltimore, I think it's outrageous. It's $150 million taken away from schools, from communities, there are all kinds of things. And I didn't see a huge opposition. I think part of rebuilding the movement is realizing where we are. And I think there are some people at the top of the union movement, officers, who think everything is great. And I think the longer they keep saying that, the longer it will be before we start to retool and reevaluate. And I think unions like the Service Employees Unite Here, where they will put resources into organizing, because most unions won't.
The question is, I wonder why some things are going on, and maybe we can answer this about the power of unions. What we're talking about here, you talk that to protect the workers, you said earlier, that the power of the unions need to protect the workers. But one of the things the unions have not been able to do, and talk about why you think this is and what can be done about it, you have tens of thousands of, let's say, steel workers, who retired steel workers. They've lost their benefits. The unions couldn't stop that, which is huge.
Sure.
These are men, mostly men, but men and women who worked in those steel mills for 30, 40 years, retired, and thought, you know, I built this middle class, I built this country, I have benefits to retire on. You've got auto workers that have been diminished in this country and been pushed back so that now they have a two-tiered system in the auto factories. So the new auto workers coming in make half of what the other autoers make and don't have the same benefit package or retirement package. So that's the kind of – so what does that say about where we are? I mean, go ahead, Corey.
So I'm definitely itching because, you know, we referenced the Harbor Point. So Mike talked about Harbor Point, and I just wanted to say, although the goal may not have been achieved, we saw that people's voices were amplified. Mm-hmm. Mark, and I haven't seen that in this city in a long time. And the reality is things don't happen overnight. But when you start to begin to engage people, actually talk to them, and they feel like they have vested interests and whatever we're dealing with. That's what I've seen out of Unite Here. I've been to about five or six of their rallies, and I've never seen them the way they are outside of the last year and a half. I've never seen SEIU is definitely growing. They're the ones that's pushing the fast food workers. So I've seen people, we're all organizing. We all realize that we're at a tough time right now. And then, you know, we talked about different legislation. So we talk about Harbor Point, but think about the home care workers that got collective bargaining rights. Think about those people on a state level. So things are happening. I think it's people that's there, but they do need help. They're the minority, the people that actually care about workers. Then we talk about, you know, we referenced, I think it's a generational thing. So when you didn't go through tough times, it's sometimes when people from the county that try to come and help people from the city, if you're not enduring it, you have no clue what it's like. You have no clue when your stomach's touching. You have no clue what it's like to be homeless. Yes, you could be sympathetic to it, but the reality is that you, if you haven't endured it, you really don't know that feeling. So I think that my generation doesn't know the feeling of having to work 14, 16 hours, having to work for wages that are just unbearable. We're getting to that point. I think that we're reaching a tipping point, but we haven't reached the screaming point to say, enough's enough, let's get to the streets.
I mean, I can speak as a parent.
Bill Berry.
And I think that the younger generation has reached that point. And what you find in numbers, and certainly in my household, young workers are living at home. And the famous story of a friend of mine who worked down at Sparrows Point when he was 18, turned 18, his father said, I'm going to put your suitcase out on the front porch. You come home today without a job on your own, you don't live here anymore. And what you're finding now is that the pay, and someone like Jasmine could tell you whether you can live on your own on what you're making down at those retail places at the airport.
Absolutely not. We can't live off of $7.25 an hour. You know, you come to work and you want full-time hours, but we don't get full-time hours.
$7.25 an hour.
$7.25 an hour.
And you're not a teenager. You're a woman.
I'm 25
That's
years old.
That's what I'm
old.
Saying. Right.
Yes.
Right. Right.
$7.25 an hour, and I'm 25 years old. And, I mean, that's not what I'm making, but that's what my coworkers are making. So, you know, you think about the long run of things. Okay, so let's say I do move out and I don't have a roommate. Am I going to be able to support myself with $7.25 an hour? Absolutely not. Am I going to be able to support myself with $7.25 and 30-plus hours? No, I'm definitely not. You know, there are some of my coworkers who come into work and they send them home because that company isn't making any money. So you mean to tell me that this person traveled from East or West Baltimore all the way to the airport and you have them there for 30 minutes and you send them home? How are they surviving? How? How are they able to make do with themselves? And not to mention, majority of these people have children. So what are they going to do?
We'll take a very brief break. We're here with Bill Berry, Cory McCray, Jasmine Jones, and Mike Hatchie. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
We're gonna roll. Hello, liver cancer. Let me introduce you to my gang of bullies.
If you've been diagnosed with any gastrointestinal cancer, consider University of Maryland Greenbaum Cancer Center. A highly specialized team of experts will review your case and recommend promising solutions, many found only at National Cancer Institute designated centers like here.
Hey, tumor, take a hike.
University of Maryland Medical Center, medicine on a mission. Learn more at umm.edu.
There's power in the fat tree, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The strikes of the bosses we must fight for. Farmlands to trenches full of mud. War's always been the boss's wiser. The union forever defending our rights. Now with the black leather workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters in many far off lands. There is power in a union. Just laws cannot defeat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone? What a comfort to the widow.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are celebrating Labor Day here on the Mark Steiner Show with our panel talking about what labor means in America today and where labor unions are going in America today. We're here with Bill Barry, retired director of the Labor Studies Program at the Community College of Baltimore County, author of the books Union Strategies for Hard Times and From First Contact to First Contract, a Union Organizer's Handbook, and a new book coming out soon, The 1877 Railroad Strike Here in Baltimore. Corey McCrae is with us. He's an organizer for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW, Local 24. He's a small business owner. He's running for the state legislature. He's co-founder of the Best Democratic Club and was a co-founder of the Young Trade Unionists, a member of Young Trade Unionists in all the AFL-CIO unions in the city, in the metro area. Jasmine Jones is with us. Jasmine is a server and union leader at Duke Law, operated by Aero Services Group at BWI Airport. Mike Hatchie, as an organizer with Unite Here Local 7, the union that is working with Jasmine and other workers to organize unions at the airport.
See, I think one of the things about unionism today, it's become almost invisible. And so unless you're like Jasmine, whose family is in a union, people think, young workers and older workers say, how am I going to do better? And a generation ago, the idea of doing better was to get into a union and either to switch jobs. But now people don't automatically think that. They think individual responses. I'm going to go to school. I need more education. I got to get computer skills and stuff like that. So the union movement needs to make itself much more noticeable and prominent so that when people have a problem at work, they think, okay, I'm going to call the organizer, and that's how we're going to solve our problem.
So going back to how I began this questioning, when you have the history that I mentioned where people are losing benefits, don't have the in the larger industries, don't have the same benefits or wages as the older workers who were the generation after the organizers of the union, two generations maybe.
So what does that say to you about where we are? I mean, what is the juxtaposition between that reality and the reality that workers in many low-wage industries, like fast food and retail and other places, are organizing? I mean, what's the disconnect here?
Well, I think you raised two issues, Mark, and I don't mean to dominate the conversation. We talked about the auto workers' decline and the two-tiered and the three-tiered systems. And in that situation, the problem is that the officers, the auto workers, have not put money into organizing. And so all of the transplants all across the South are non-union. And they don't have pensions. They have 401Ks. They have...
You're talking about the auto factories that have moved to Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama.
Absolutely.
Right.
Greenville, South Carolina, right. Alabama, right, places right. like that. It's cheaper to build a car here than it is in Europe. And so I think putting the resources into organizing, and Mike can certainly tell you that it's an expensive and a risky proposition. And the members complain because where's my dues dollar going? I need it here in front of me. I think for the steel workers, the issue was a decision made in the late 40s by the union officers not to support a national health care. And Truman proposed it. And what happens is when Bethlehem Steel went bankrupt, for example, they had 14,000 retirees just in the Dundalk area. And it's enormous cost for a company to carry, never mind the catastrophe for the individual workers who lose their health insurance. And so some of these problems are not solved by organizing on a workplace by workplace, but they have a social solution. A single-payer health plan would save each of us $4,000 or $5,000 a year and would cover everybody and would really eliminate that kind of tragedy of people being without health care. So I think each situation really is different, and some of the decisions were made many years ago and are now coming back to haunt us.
Mike, you want to jump in? Then we'll go over here to Corey.
Sure. I mean, I think in many ways the loss of these industrial jobs is the story of how we got where we are now with the situation being so bad for working people in Baltimore today. And what we've seen is a strategy from the city that these jobs that were lost are going to be replaced by jobs in food and retail by promoting the kind of development that we've seen over the last decades
in the harbor. Non-union food and retail.
Exactly. And that's the question we've got to be asking. If, as a city, we're going to subsidize companies and ask them to come into Baltimore on the promise of good jobs, what are we going to demand from them? How are we going to make these jobs that actually replace the jobs that were lost? Because now, as Jasmine described, these jobs are not replacing living wage jobs that were here in the past. And when workers stand up and fight in the harbor, in the airport, in these development projects, they're pushing back against the legacy of decades of failed development projects, and they're fighting to make these fair development.
Corey, then go to Jasmine.
So I guess I want to disagree and I want to agree on one point.
All right.
I challenge wherever we're at that point. So from the books that I read, people were dying in the coal mines. People didn't have health care. People were working until they were 80. People were working instead of going to school. I don't think that we've reached the conditions to where I got a cut on my leg or my leg's cut off. So I think that we have to reach the point where you can't take any more. And the point that you see that you've got to that point is when you see people between 18 to 40 where the firefighters, the police officers, the City Union of Baltimore, everybody just went through the last 3 years of the tier system pensions. When they're telling you your pension is a 401k is better than a pension and trying to play these mind games with you. When I see so many of my friends working without health care and they don't look at it like it's a problem. Well, I'm making $18, but you don't have health care. Mm-hmm. When I have friends, like she said, that have the low wage and they are just so frustrated, or the tier systems that may have been with wherever you worked at Giants, wherever you worked at the UAW, when you see 18 to 40 come out and say, we're not going to have that anymore, that's when you know that you're at that point, Mark. I think that organizing is the key to this thing. I think that that is what Local 7 is doing right now. They are organizing at a point that I haven't seen them do in the last 2 years. SEIU is organizing. Professor Barry is always pushing different past stories and pushing organizing. When you begin to double back and teach a worker such as myself, Jasmine, myself, or our generation, hey, this is what it was like when we were coming up, when our parents were coming up, and get us to understand and say, you guys are getting very close to identifying with how it was. Double back, educate the people that are sympathetic, the young workers that are sympathetic, and then let them know, hey, if you don't do something, it's going to get very worse. So I think that organizing is the key. I do 100% agree with.
Jasmine, look like you're about to say something about that too.
I mean, I agree. I totally agree because being a union leader at my job, it's very hard to kind of shake the boat. So, and what I mean by shaking the boat is okay, I have five people who are like, I'm fed up. I don't want to do this anymore. This is not something that I'm going to do. But then you have to go to those five people and say, listen, I know that you're fed up. There's a way to go about these things. Let's do it together. But then when you have your company, on the other hand, like, huh, we're going to fire you anyway, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that, with the repercussions behind it, organizing is hard. But in the same token, I don't want to take away from what any of these gentlemen are saying. Organizing is the key into getting these unions in and keeping these unions alive. Now, the money situation, as far as like dues, because that's always going to be a situation. Oh, I don't want to pay this because I don't see where it's going. Well, you know, where I'm working right now, I would rather pay dues than to pay what it is I'm paying. It's the gist of the situation. We work at an airport where they're making so much money. You know, this money that they're making, $6 billion a week, like, what could I do with $6 billion a week? But what can my coworkers do? Like, we don't have health care. You know, we don't have anything. Okay, so a few of my coworkers have fell on the job and, you know, they've hurt different parts of their bodies and things like that. And we're not talking about, you know, on the grass or on cement. We're actually working on cement, you know, around with the, you know, food and things like that. And they're hurt, but they come to work because they don't have any time off. They don't have, you know, any way to go to a doctor because they don't want that doctor bill. And why I'm saying this is because I can see it. I don't think a lot of other people can see the vision, but I can see it. And I know that what it is I'm doing inside of my workplace is for a reason.
No, I don't need no man. pin him in the sand. And if it's open, he comes up rolling by Sam. Now, Lynette, he's driving me, Lord, Lord. Now, Lynette, he's driving me. Now, Lynette, he's driving me, Lord, Lord. Now, Lynette, he's driving me.
I think that a couple of things came out of this round of our conversations. One of them, I don't think people do know, unless people, as you were saying, live and work in certain conditions in this country. People don't know what people go through or what it's like mm-hmm. to have to be in those working situations. And it's also, Dan, as you were saying, that because since there's no union, since the shop isn't organized, let's say at Duke Law or at Taco Bell or other places that exist at the airport, you could be fired.
Yes.
And there's very little the union at this point or anybody else could do if they fire the worker.
Well, if they're organizing and if they got to organize a campaign, it is rules and regulations with the National Labor Relations Board. Now, workers do get fired, but there are repercussions to kind of get that worker their job back, get them that back pay. And it is very challenging. It's not something that's easy, but I'm saying it is supposed to be rules and regulations that protect workers from organizing with organizing.
Were you about to say something, Bill?
Well, I was just going to say that Jasmine is the poster child for the future. And her thinking and her courage are what made the union movement start in the first place. Going back to the first strike on the pyramids back in 300 BC.
And which they've now documented, by the way. The last five years ago, they documented there actually were worker strikes building the pyramids.
Over the rations of corn.
That's right.
I wouldn't say something that's not true. But I think one of the things that's important when you read over articles, for example, about the March on Washington, so much of it is based on what the government's got to do, and certainly that's important. But I think what's most important for Labor Day is that workers need to understand this is something which is in their control. It is a challenge they have to take. And this country was built on people taking risks and meeting challenges, and whether it's immigrants coming over or people moving west or working in these terrible conditions, that's the future. And when someone like Jasmine will say, I'm willing to take that challenge, I'm willing to take that risk, and I'm willing to reach out to my coworkers, that's the future right there. And if you could clone her and multiply her by 100,000 or 200,000, the next Labor Day show would be a lot happier.
I think that everyone in this room, as we've been talking about a moment ago, in many ways embodies the spirit of what, from different perspectives politically on some levels, but embodies the spirit of a union future in America. And I want to explore that for a bit more, what that really means. Because while the vigor of everything people talked about in the first part of this program was very real, and it exists, and we've been covering union strikes and union organizing in this program for the last 20 years, and trying to put that on the map and the people can hear and understand what's going on, and producing stories like the voices of the working poor in America so people can hear their own and people's voices. So to get that out there, so people hear that. Having said all that, the stats seem to be working against everything people are saying in this room, that unions are down to barely to nothing in this society, that we're down to, as I said, 6% of private sector workers from 35% high in the 1950s. So, and you're trying to organize private sector workers at Unite Here, right?
Absolutely.
And we're even losing members in, I said we, I guess I meant we, we're losing workers in the public sector as well. I mean, you know, when I was an organizer for the American Federation of Teachers way back in the late 70s, that was, you know, we're building a union. And that union kind of has lost its way in many ways in our own community here. But so the question is, why the optimism? What is this? We're at a really low point, it seems to me, in the last 75 years or 80 years of union activity in America. It's very tough to organize. The laws are set against. The law has been set against since Staff Hartley in 1948, which we can talk about in a minute. So what are your thoughts about that? I don't mean to be just pushing the negative. I'm trying to be realistic.
I always say that
Bilberry.
When people get discouraged, some people say, well, I get discouraged, I read the Bible. I say when I get discouraged, I read labor history. Because what you see is periods exactly like this, where workers stood up and got hammered and went down. And the idea that the Taft-Hartley law was the first one, anti-union laws go back to the Middle Ages. the Statute of Laborers, which forbid organizing by agricultural workers in England in 1349. So workers have always had to fight against that and have. And it's not a mystical quality, but I have to keep coming back to Jasmine. She has got that fire that this is what I got to do. And we need to spread that. I mean, yes, unions are 6% of the workforce. That's 15 to 20 million people. That's a lot of people, and there are a lot of resources if they were properly allocated. And as I said, we need to become visible. One of the real regrets is that there's no longer a Labor Day parade in Baltimore or in Maryland. And we had one in Dundalk for a number of years, and when I retired, it kind of nobody picked it up. And that's the thing that young people need to see. They need to see what the people in New York saw. In that first Labor Day parade, people were sitting on the awnings, they were sitting on rooftops, they were watching the parade, and it was union members saying, we are here, we are visible, maybe not as many of us as we want, but we are here, take a look at us. And that's what we got to do again.
I would go to the point.
Go ahead, Corey.
I would go to the point in reference of organizing, and I guess I've been in the labor movement for about 10, 11 years now. I get to see firsthand the amount of resources that the AFL-CIO, that the IBEW is investing in organizing. And I haven't seen this many resources allocated outside of the last 2 or 3 years to organize. And I think that he stated, Professor Barry stated it in the beginning of the program, you have to get serious about organizing and willing to accept whether you're African-American, whether you're Hispanic, whether you're a woman, whether you're a man, you have to be open to all and very diverse, open and very diverse. And I think that that's what we're seeing in our local union. Now, some haven't got on board yet, Mark. That's the reality. But I see a lot of the progressive unions and a lot of the unions that have the resources change the direction the way they're using their resources and more open to organizing at this point.
Well, how Jasmine. I feel about this is you know, I've been sitting back thinking, and there's one thing that I don't think that people even really realize because they're not in the workplace. So what I see is there really aren't any union. There's not any type of union activity. And why it hasn't been any union activity is because the companies, private or big-time companies, know how to keep the union out. They know how to, hey, I'll give you this if you don't say this. So I know how to give you that without giving you this. So they kind of like try to keep us satisfied at a distance. But when you know the real and you know what you're supposed to be getting and what you're not getting, it's kind of hard not to see what it's supposed to be. Meaning, I know I'm supposed to be getting benefits, but if they pay me $12 an hour, I think I can take that doctor bill, maybe, if I'm by myself. And it's one of those things where if you just look in the future, like, I'm not guaranteed, you know, a perfect bill of health, so I need to go to the doctor. But most people my age don't even think about that. They think about the dollar signs. They think about what's being thrown at them now. And they're losing sight of what could be the future? What is the future? So I look at that, and then I also look at the way that they anti-union. You know, the whole, oh, we don't want this because, you know, it's going to be taken out of our pockets. And, you know, if this is taken out of our pockets, and we can't give you this and things like that. I see it. I know I see it. And like I said, I have to go back to my mother. Like, I remember seeing my mother come home crying because, you know, they're not doing what it is they're supposed to do. She can't take time off from me because I'm sick or whatever the situation may have been. But she stuck it out. And I'm going to do it right. I'm going to stick it out, too. So I'm here.
You listen to the Mark Steiner Show. We'll take a very brief break and come back with our Labor Day conversation.
Joe Hill come over from Sweden shore, looking for some work to do, and the Statue of Liberty waved him by. As Joe come a sailing through Joe Hill, as Joe come a sailing through. Oh, his clothes were coarse and his hopes were high as he headed for the promised land. Took a few weeks on the out-of-work streets before he began to understand. understand before he began to understand. Then Joe got hired by Bowery Bar, sweeping up the saloon. As his rag would sail o'er the barroom rail, sounded like he whistled on a tune. You could almost hear him whistling on a tune. And Joe rolled on from job to job, from the docks to the railroad line. And no matter how hungry the hand that wrote, in his letters he was always doing fine. In his letters he was always doing fine. Oh, the years went by like the sun going down, slowly turned the page. And when Joe looked back at the sweat upon his tracks, he had nothing to show but his age. He had nothing to show but his age. So he headed out for the California shore. There things were just as bad. So he joined the industrial workers of the world, 'cause the union was the only friend he had. 'Cause the union was the only friend he had. Now the strikes were bloody and the strikes were black, as hard as they were long. In the dark of the night, Joe would stay awake and write. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. In the morning, he would raise them with a song. And he wrote his words to the tunes of the day, to be passed along the union by. And the strikes were led and the songs were spread, and Joe Hill was always on the line. Yes, Joe Hill was always on the line. City, a murder was made. There was hardly food to find. Oh, the proof was poor, but the sheriff was sure that Joe was the killer of the crime.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
Are you cold, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack. Boo, why don't you buck like thunder? And dump the bosses off your back. All the agonies you suffer, you could end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back.
Welcome back. As I said earlier, we're here with Bill Berry, Corey McRae, Jasmine Jones, and Mike Hatchie as we look at the future of labor and labor unions in America. This is a semi-sidebar, but I think it's kind of critical to the issue we're talking about. Now, let's say at the airport where you all are working in and or organizing low-wage workers working in all these places. Many of the other people working at the airport are unionized.
Yes.
The guys who, men and women who work outside in the baggage department, the folks who are fixing the engines are unionized, the stewardesses are unionized. There are a lot of unions at the airport. Yes.
Flight attendants.
Flight attendants.
Not
what did
stewardesses.
I say? Excuse me. I'm from a different era and I made a mistake. Thank you, Bill.
Sexism is alive and well.
Oh, my God.
The TSA workers just organized. Huh? Couple years ago.
The TSA. So is there any solidarity? I don't believe I actually said that, but is there any solidarity between those unions and the efforts that Unite Here are making to organize at the airport, and how does that play itself out?
See, I'm not sure. Mike would have to, like, you know, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not sure. Like, I've been talking to a few of the people, I know a few TSA workers, I know a few of the baggage handlers, I know a few of the flight attendants, and
a look was kind of close when she said that word, flight attendants.
Flight attendants. So, and a lot of them say, you know, we support you guys and everything it is that you're doing. Now, as far as how they organize, I'm not sure. I'm just coming into the airport. I've been there just about 2 years now. So I'm just coming in. I wasn't there for their fight. But a lot of them were telling me they did pickets. They did, you know, they did all of the things that they needed to do in order to get a union in. In our situation, I feel like there's a higher being, and the higher being is not recognizing our union. You know, they're not recognizing it because they point the finger at each other. Oh, it's your company. Oh, no, it's not us, it's them. It's the company. No, it's not us, it's them. So it's like a battle within the airport, you know, of who wants to take responsibility of letting this union in. Nobody wants to take that responsibility.
So is there solidarity in this?
Absolutely. And our union supported the Federation of Government Employees as they organized the TSA workers a number of years ago. And I think there's that daily solidarity of workers at the airport sharing their experiences with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's a community there. And ramp agents know the food and retail workers, who know people who work for the airlines and everyone else. And I think where there's a gap is it's well known that some of the jobs are better than others at the airport, and it's desirable to get a job as a TSA agent, mm-hmm, or a flight attendant or a ramp agent. But not everybody knows that the reason those are better jobs is that people have fought and organized and made unions. Well, and
let me push this a tad further. We have Tad Hartley in 1948. I'm going to play Fantasyland, but not quite Fantasyland here for a moment, okay? We had Taft-Hartley in 1948 that limited the ability of unions to organize and really – put a crimp on the ability to go in, like as opposed to Canada, where you can walk in with a card, sign up, it's done. There's no, they can't stop you. Supposing all the fast food workers were organized and being organized at the airport, decided to walk in one day and then walk out. Would those other unions honor those picket lines? Would the TSA workers, the mechanics, flight attendants, any others say, no, I'm not working today. I'm not crossing this picket line. We're going to shut the airport down until the workers, whether it's for this one-day strike, would that happen?
Well, I think that those in power—
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, because you're not the union president. Well, you're not running the union. But just, you know,
well, let me say that that is what those in power are most afraid of. That and that is
exactly
why,
but if we don't use it, this
and that is and that that's why we have Taft-Hartley. That's why we have a whole history of anti-union laws. Is that workers acting as workers have the most restrictions on their freedom of speech of anybody I can think of. You know, the moment that we're together as a union, then we're up against a whole system designed to stop people from acting together. And I think that's why some of these one-day strikes in fast food are so inspirational, because it is bucking that system and refusing to play by those rules. And I think that the reality for workers organizing in 2013 is that they're on an unlevel playing field. The deck is stacked against them. And companies have become experts at using their anti-union consultants, at using fear and intimidation campaigns, at trying to keep people divided, scared, and doing anything else except coming together and fighting for their own interests, that it's all the more amazing to see people standing up at BWI, now standing up at the Hyatt, because workers are looking those odds straight on and taking them on.
I think you go back to your question, Mark, and it's a really good one, because it revives an epic moment in labor history, which was the Petco strike.
Yes.
And the reason that came unraveled is because there had been a history at the airport of scabbing on each other.
Let me say, we're stepping backwards in history. This is in the 1981. When
air traffic controllers
went on strike and Ronald Reagan broke the union. That's what he's talking about.
Well, what broke the union was that the other unions, the machinists particularly, the airline pilots, flight attendants union, refused to honor the air traffic controllers' picket line. And unfortunately, it was payback because the air traffic controllers had refused to honor picket lines previous to that. But airports have a unique labor history all their own.
And it endorsed Ronald Reagan, the Republican candidate.
And PASCO did. But I think the unions that came in, and it was a historic test, the new head of the AFL, Lane Kirkland, just come in, and the bosses said, let's give this guy a test, and he failed. And the other unions did not respect those picket lines. And I think that's something that exactly what you're talking about, that the fast food workers at the airport are the most vulnerable and most easily replaced compared to a pilot. And so the other unions need to show that solidarity. And if there were a strike, and the other unions, the pilots said, well, if they're picketing the Duclos Brewery, I'm not going into work, that strike would be over in a half an hour because that's bargaining power and leverage.
But the reality is I think about, and I only get to read about PATCO, I only get to read about the different things, but the strike work, and I'm not saying that that's the ideal solution for right now, but is a reality? Is that a realistic solution? Is it going to happen? No, people live check to check. The company has the ability to hire replacement workers, and then let's say that they do get in with a collective bargaining agreement. They don't have to hire those workers that went out on a strike. So as that PATCO kind of put it, a different play, it put a different move. So we have to think outside of the box and come up something with our own 2013 way of a strike. I think that it's still economics is what surrounds everything. I'm not sure if it's nobody goes to that place or does business at that place and patronize that establishment, that business. But I challenge whether a strike would work. I know that the ideal solution, but I'm just not sure you can get everybody on the same page is what I'm saying, Mo.
Let me push this a bit further because this is part of the game I think of the future to play, just how it gets organized. And so are we saying that, let's say that, I mean, right now the fast food workers around the country are doing these really interesting strikes because they're striking for one day across every business in the city that they're targeting. Not just one company, not just Taco Bell, not just McDonald's. Everybody gets targeted. So, and that's very powerful. The next day, churches walk in and say, you better keep these people employed. And that's part of the whole strategy we're on. I think it's a very interesting and smart strategy. But taking this step further, just in terms of where unions have to go to show their strength, are we saying, Corey, that that major unions like the IBEW or other major unions should not, let's say there was a one-day strike, shouldn't honor that line, shouldn't say, no, we're all going to shut this down? I mean, can you imagine what would happen if, let me throw this out a little bit more, a little absurdist, and people say, but I don't think it is. Let's say that during the negotiations here in the city, and the city was trying to take away more of the benefit rights and salaries of unionized workers in Baltimore. So wasn't every worker in Baltimore said one day, teachers, firemen, police, secretaries, trash workers, sanitation workers, excuse me, whatever you're supposed to say, that they all said one day,
we're going to shut it down.
We're shutting it down one day. Go back to work the next day. We're showing you our power. Don't the unions have to show their power for people to look up and take notice that
But one,
them on notice?
One day is realistic, but you think about the PATCO strike. It wasn't one day. So the reality is that, yeah, Mike could call in sick and say, hey, I'm not coming in. I'm showing solidarity. I got a sick day. You know what? Maybe you do it 3 days. But what if it's a week? What if it's 2 weeks? What if it's 3 months? That's when the back gets broken. Hey, I can't survive without making a living for 3 months, and that's where the challenges come. Yeah, we can have a short-term gain, but what's the long in road? And that's what I think that we need to be thinking about. And I think that that's the situation in the PATCO thing. It dragged on and people couldn't sustain. The businesses could hold out. Yeah, they could lose a million. Yeah, they can probably lose 10 million. But the long term, who can hold out the longest, workers or the businesses?
Let me just go back to the original point of today. the original Labor Day parade, people took off work. It was exactly what you were talking about, Mark. There was no legal holiday or we're going to let you off for today. They said, this is important enough for us. We're going to take the day off. We're going to go without pay, and we're going to march.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our life shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we bring the greater days. The rising of the women means the rising of the race. No more the drudge and idler tend that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
What are your thoughts, Jasmine? You're a new young worker, new young organizer. What do you think?
I think that we could be powerful. I mean, I would like to see us, you know, shut the whole airport down because we're not getting what it is we want, but the reality is that we need money. You know, we come to this place because we need money. And, you know, I would like to see everybody who is in a union, you know, support us. Like, we are the newbies. Like, we are new, fresh. So I'm not saying that they won't support us, but it's not likely. I mean, I make your food, you come and you eat, and, you know, you tell me that you support us and everything like that, but will you do it is the question. I don't know whether or not they would do it. I'm hoping that that's something that they would do, but I'm not sure. I can't put my last dollar on it.
So I guess the envelope I was pushing is whether the unions have to show some serious muscle.
It's called solidarity.
To make it work in this country, to really make it to be felt.
Absolutely.
To show the power, just even if it's just for a day, to show power, that the power is there. That, you know, that's what happened in when they had the fight against austerity cuts in Spain and other countries in Europe, it was the workers who stood up and went, no. So, I mean, that's where the power lived. I'm sorry, you're going to say what, Corey?
Man, I was going to say I'm 100% in agreement. I look at the fast food strike. I saw that on every channel that I was watching in reference to news. Even my local TVs was talking about this fast food strike. So you do need, but the one day could be powerful. One day could be powerful. You get in those billionaire pockets for one day and you realize, hey, but you got to make it worth the while. You know, you got to make it. Bring that attention. You got to build up to something. And I think that the 50-state strike that happened yesterday wasn't the first one. I think that they did like 20 states the month before, you know, so it's got to build to something.
Talk about how that worked. How did that strike work? This one-day strike of fast food workers, how did that work?
Well, across the country, people organized. And I think when we have these huge visions of could we shut the city down, could we shut the airport down, you know, we've got to do – the real concrete work that gets us there, knocking on the doors, talking person by person to our coworkers. And I think we've really got to know our own history, because our history is what shows us that it's not impossible. And actually what you described, a municipal strike shutting Baltimore down, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, but we were there in 1973, weren't we? Mm-hmm. A major municipal strike that began with the sanitation workers spread even to the police. And that same year, there was a month-long strike at a hotel that's now called the Sheraton City Center. Then it was called the Hilton. And that was a hotel subsidized and built with taxpayer dollars all the way back to the 50s. That was a project that was unfair for workers. Workers fought and turned that into fair development by striking for over a month. Nothing easy about it. Absolutely nothing easy about it. And I think we've got to remember that we're standing on the foundation of a long and powerful movement. And we've got many forces now who want us to forget that history, who want us to think that the goal of being able to strike like that is too far away, too impossible. There's too many laws in our way. And we've got to do the work person by person. That's the only way we've ever got there.
Listen, young people. Listen to me. Don't try to buy no home down in Washington, D.C., because it's a free fall town. Ooh, it's a free fall town. I got a wish for blues, I'm gonna spread it all around. Me and my sweet wife and Miss Barnacle run all over that town. Everywhere we go, the people, they would turn us down, Lord, in a wish for town. Ooh, it's a wish for town. I got a wish for blues, I'm gonna spread it all around. Some white folks in Washington, they know just how. Some of colored man a nickel just to see him by, Lord, in a Bridgeport town. Ooh, it's a Bridgeport town. I got a Bridgeport blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. Sweet white Marty was standing up there. Heard a white man say, I don't want no Negroes up there. He was a Bridgeport man. Woo, living in a Bridgeport town. I got a Bridgeport blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. This is the home of the brave, the land of the free. I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie, Lord, in a Bridgeport town. Town. I got a wish for blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around.
So tell me how important, given this, the fast food workers world, and also the demonization of salaries in this country overall, and more workers being pushed into what's even considered official poverty lines. I mean, you know that if you're a single mother with making $23,000 a year, $24,000 a year, you're not in poverty. Not by the official standard anyway.
You spend that in a night, Mark. I know.
Wish what is these lies he's putting out there? He just, I wish that was true. Good Lord, that would be great.
Put it out there and see if it sticks.
Yeah, really, man. I'll take it. Throw it at me. If someone wants to give me that kind of money, I'm going to take it. But that's probably most of the media today. They are taking that kind of money, which is why they have no understanding what real people go through. That is the reality. But so how important is it to raise the minimum wage? How important is it from your perspectives that this campaign is this campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15, whatever that number is? How important is that?
It's very important, because if you think about it, like, I don't think people are looking at the long run of the situation. They're thinking about right now. If I give this person, random number, $15 an hour, what are they going to do with this money? Like, what is it that they can possibly do? Well, they're going to raise this tax, and they're going to take this away. They're going to add more to this. But if they are making more money, aren't they spending more money? So aren't they going to the grocery store to spend this money? And if they are, if they're getting $15 an hour, aren't they able to support themselves and not be on public assistance? It just makes sense to me. It doesn't make sense to keep somebody at seven something an hour and they can't afford groceries, which puts them back on public assistance, which puts their kids back on public assistance. It doesn't make sense. Like, why not raise it so that everybody is on an equal playing field? It doesn't make sense.
We'll take a very brief break. We're here with Bill Berry, Cory McCrae, Jasmine Jones, and Mike Hatchie. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
There's a better world that's a-coming. Tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming. Tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world a-coming, and don't you know, no. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know. I'm a union man in a union war. It's a union world I'm fighting for. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you know. There's a better world that's a-coming. There's a better world that's a-coming. There's a better world that's a-coming. I'll tell you why. Don't you see. And don't you know, no. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. Better world that's coming, tell you why. Out of marching, out of battling, you can hear the chains are rattling. There's a better world that's coming, I'll tell you why. Now there's a better world that's coming, and there's a better world that's coming, and there's a better world that's coming, I'll tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. Better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. We'll beat them on the land, in the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, I'll tell you why. Well, there's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. Better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union, and we'll all be free. There's a better world a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world a-coming, don't you see. Better world a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see.
The Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. What if you're struggling with your mortgage? The state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper.
raise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying to those observers, armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are celebrating Labor Day here on the Mark Steiner Show with our panel talking about what labor means in America today and where labor unions are going in America today. We're here with Bill Berry, retired director of the Labor Studies Program at the Community College of Baltimore County, author of the books Union Strategies for Hard Times and From First Contact to First Contract, A Union Organizer's Handbook, and a new book coming out soon, The 1877 Railroad Strike Here in Baltimore. Corey McCray is with us. He's an organizer for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW, Local 24. He's a small business owner. He's running for the state legislature. He's co-founder of the Best Democratic Club and was a co-founder of the Young Trade Unionists, a made up of young trade unionists in all the AFL-CIO unions in the city, in the metro area. Jasmine Jones is with us. Jasmine is a server and union leader at Duke Law, operated by Aero Services Group at BWI Airport. Mike Hatchie is an organizer with Unite Here Local 7, the union that is working with Jasmine and other workers to organize unions at the airport. One of the things that you hear a lot, though, and you hear it everywhere you go, my wife just heard it not long ago when she was working out, and had discussion began about after one of the other one-day strikes that took place. It was on the TV screen, and many people who come from working-class backgrounds themselves and are working hard for a living themselves said they shouldn't get $15 an hour. I should be making $15 an hour. Why should they? Why should somebody slinging a hamburger get $15 an hour? What about our teachers? What about everybody else? And so, I mean, that is a prevailing, that is a sense that a lot of people have when they hear that somebody, because they think of fast food workers as teenagers, mm-hmm. as opposed to reality, the vast majority now of fast food workers are adults, women, trying to make a living and keep alive. They're not kids anymore. So, but to talk about that for a minute, because that is, people listening to this broadcast are saying right now, what are you talking about? You need $15 an hour to sling a hamburger.
Well, see, I want people to understand that, you know, a lot of people who work in these fast food restaurants, they don't, like, I work with probably about six people who have graduated high school and college, and, you know, they can't find a job in their field. So you fill out applications, and whatever calls you back, you go to that job and you make it work. Me, myself, I've gone to school, finished high school, I did trade school. I can't find anything in the field that it is that I want to work in. So, you know, I came back home to take care of my dad, and, you know, I had to find a job. It was something that I had to find right then and there. You know, he wasn't working. Somebody had to pay the bills in the household. So for somebody who is going out here saying, okay, I'm going to take whatever it is I get, but I'm doing this work. I'm the front line of this job. You know, I'm doing everything it is that I could possibly do. I'm on time. I'm doing my job properly. You know, I'm getting cut, burnt, scraped, you know, whatever it is on this job. You should, you know, at least show me some type of appreciation, you know, whether it be a dollar or $2 or $3. But in these companies, they don't even believe in raises. So where do we go from there?
So where do we go from there? How would you all respond to the people who said what I said?
I guess I had to, I was faced with that situation. I had a candidate that was running for the city council back in 2011, and they were saying, hey, I need to brush up on my union issues. I think that you're a good union person. Can you help me out? So I'm explaining a couple things, and I said, well, what's your issue? I think the firefighters and the police were going through this pension thing with the mayor. And I said, well, how do you feel about pensions? And he said, well, Corey, the reality is that I got a 401k. And, you know, why should they have a pension? So I'm faced with this. And I, like, get hysterical. I say, what is wrong with you? You're running for elected office, and you don't think under the ability to lift everyone up to the same standards, you want to break down the conditions for these people, and you are going to be a public official. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. But that's the thing. We shouldn't – if you're making $7 or $8 and I'm making 30-some dollars, why can't we lift you up to 15? Why can't we lift you up to a certain thing the way you can sustain for yourself? And the reality is she hit on my points. That's why I didn't have to say anything. You're going to spend more at your local grocer. You're going to spend more trying to send your kid to college. You're going to spend more on your mortgage or your rent. The people are holding a lot of money. When regular folks, Professor Burr, yourself that spends $12,000 or whatever, $24,000, whatever, tonight, you know, we spend our money through our daily routines. Yeah. And it's a lot of people. It's, you know, it's a small percentage of people that's holding on to all the money, and it's not circulating in our economy. And when you do that, when you're spending more, the state, the municipality, the federal government is getting more in taxes. You know, so everybody, it's a win-win for a lot of people. Small businesses are winning. The government is winning. The regular person that's just got the wage increase, it has to happen. And I see a lot more people getting on board with the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage.
Let's see the bitter worker whose labor paid little in return. Struggling to meet the monthly bills with the little that she earns. And I've seen the developer and the banker with the double-bladed loan, who in the name of economic law pushes people out their homes. And I've seen yellow haze, where the number crunchers and corporate thieves are now counting down their days. And I know we got a long way to go, but we're on the right track. Yeah, we're on the right track. And I've seen the gang fighter with a misplaced but justified
better.
we've had this argument for all my life, and I think that the issue is that people
not
are,
you and me, it's about society in general.
No. I've had the argument with all as an organizer for many years,
right.
And I think the whole divide and conquer is at work there, and it's the high skilled workers versus the low skilled. It's the native born versus the immigrant. It's men versus women, blacks versus white. Keeps us quarreling among ourselves. And you can't develop that thing we called solidarity, which is really what Labor Day celebrates. And I think you have to say to people that when you worry about saving money or who's got how much, you're taking the company's point of view, the boss's point of view, because it doesn't look at what Jasmine needs to live and raise her family. You're looking at what's profitable for the employers, and that's the biggest mistake. And people have to start looking at the point of view of another worker. And show that solidarity and show that understanding. Because one of the things you say to people is, exactly, we're talking the candidate that Corey was talking about, whoever it was, that candidate has lost conditions when they go from a pension to a 401k. And eventually what's been happening over the last 30 years, they've been getting us all, and even the people who had it. And I was talking to some people from Verizon yesterday. They used to have fully paid health insurance for retirees, Cadillac plan, no more.
So
if we don't all go forward, we're all going to go backward.
Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution, because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I do. Oh, your Constitution. Gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about the destruction of all the evil. It will have to end.
Here we're seeing all the contradictions coming out, I think, in this conversation about both the hope of possibility of what unions can do for America and change America and the working people in America. On the other hand, as Bill was describing just a moment ago, and we have all talked about at varying points in this conversation, there are things that really do blunt and block workers' progress. Yeah. Loss of benefits. And that's one of the big ones. In major industries. So doesn't that make it harder to organize when people can come back to you and say, what do you mean? Why should I organize? Why should I have a union when you can't even protect the benefits of the
tier
workers?
Systems.
And the other unions, you can't protect Verizon workers, you can't protect auto workers, you can't protect steel workers. Why should I join your union? What do you say?
I say that the union is us. A lot of people think that the union is this big people that's sitting over here. The union is the workers. The union is... What the workers are what makes up the union. I belong to so many different clubs. I send $10 or whatever checks. I send, you know, I like listening to Mark. We have to invest in the things that we care about. And my workplace is what I care about. A collective bargaining agreement in my workplace is what I care about. I always tell people we have contracts for the most important things of our life. Whether you rent or you own, you have a contract. You have some form of agreement. Whether you rent or own your car, you have some form of agreement. When you purchase the things, they give you a receipt and you know. Well, why can't we have a contract or agreement for our workplace conditions? And it's just like we said, if you're not within a union, and you're an at-will employee. So as long as the employer isn't breaking any form of a federal law, where it's race, age, or discrimination, some sort of that, that guy can get rid of you if you got your head 10 inches. You know, if he doesn't like white and blue shirts, you know what? I need you to go. So it's nothing that protects that worker. But a collective bargaining agreement does do that.
Any other thoughts on that question about how do you explain to brothers and sisters that you want to organize into a union after what I just was describing?
Well, we already don't have benefits, so you can't go backwards. You know what I mean? Like, our company already doesn't offer certain things, so why not try to push them to offer these things? You know, he's right. You know, we deserve some type of a contract saying that if we do our job, you are supposed to, you know, help us out in the long run. You know, it's amazing to me. It's amazing to me that, you know, like I said, my coworkers have children. And these kids probably won't go to college because, you know, they don't have any money, or they won't be able to go to the doctor without having to go down to social service and stand in a line because they're sick. Like, it's just crazy to me. And these are the people who come in and take care of your customers and or, you know, do your job, which you're not doing, you know, and you don't want to pay them or you don't want to give them anything to help and better themselves. Like, come on, like, it doesn't make sense. And he's right. You know, I've seen people leave out of the door for, you know, crazy stuff. You know, your socks aren't white, or, you know, your shoes are too flat, or, and so you're getting rid of me because either you don't want to pay for me in the long run, and or you just want to get rid of me because it's easier for you to do.
So let me ask a couple of questions here before we run out of time and close out here with your visions of the 21st century in labor. I want to hear what you all think about where we could and should go. But one of the things that has divided the working class and divided unions in this country for a long time is race. Mm-hmm. You know, it was able to break the backs of strikes. It's been able to tear unions apart. We had segregated unions in this city. When I was growing up, you know, the Carpenters Union was segregated. The Longshore had segregated locals. This is, and, you know, that was the reality of that. And now we're the majority of union, the growing majority of union members are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this country more and more divided around issues of race again. Or this coming to the fore in the news and in our society. What about how race will play in the 21st century in unions and organizing and making this work?
Well, unions have to be multicultural, multiracial. There's just no way around it. And when I first came here to Baltimore years ago as an organizing director for the union, they had traditionally been an all-white union. And we went out and we were organizing in Baltimore and bringing in different races and nationalities. The officers panicked. They just couldn't deal with that. And I think the hope is the new generation, the younger generation, is not, at least in this area, as eaten up with those kind of prejudices as their parents were. And you see a lot more tolerance, a lot more interracial dating and friends, intersexual, you know, the fear of someone's sexuality or being gay or bisexual or whatever does not seem to be the feature of the new generation, the millennials. And I think that's great hope, because that's one less thing to overcome. And obviously, as Jasmine has so eloquently described, the bosses have got a million reasons to tell you why not to belong to the union. And they'll use all those resources and all that time, and the company that can't spare you from the floor for 5 minutes will take you for an hour into some meeting to talk about the union. Mm-hmm. And that they have no problem doing. And I think that's the issue that people have to overcome. But I think working together, knowing people, dating together, intermarrying, all that kind of stuff, I think in a lot of areas and I cannot speak for the South, but a lot of the areas that I'm familiar with up here in the North, the race issue is not quite as powerful as it used to be. Now, Garrett County, Western Pennsylvania, that I don't
speak to. Well, what do you think about race and the future of unions in America? That's just clearly...
Well, I'm seeing now, especially like working in the airport, that they see that, you know, not just, you know, African Americans are, you know, standing up for this one thing. Like, I have Mexicans, I have, you know, Africans. We have, like, our union at the airport is just, it's mixed and it's diverse. And I'm so in love with it because they know that, you know, even with you being a white American, you are not spared at all. You are not spared. So I feel like, you know, we're coming to a thing where, you know, we're all friends. I've gone to high schools where, you know, there's all white people and there's one black person. And so, and they haven't treated me any different. So I don't see color. But in a union, you definitely can see that, okay, well, I went to college, I did this and I did that. And then on the other hand, you have somebody who's a dropout who maybe, you know, didn't finish school or whatever, but we're mixing and we're mingling together. But as long as we are together and we can see past each other's color and background, I think that the union can work.
Gentlemen, amen. Please.
I'm with Jasmine. I'm with Professor Berry. I think that solidarity is the key. I think that that's what I've learned. As Jasmine stated, you know, I went to schools where it was 95% African-American. It really wasn't many things. I didn't kind of interact with a whole many Caucasians until I got into my union or got into the workplace. And, you know, it's a great feeling. It's what's necessary. It's what has to be done. And it shows what this country is made of. We're always diverse. We're age, race, female, gender. You have to be open to all, and that's how you're going to be, because then that small percentage of people that control that money can't divide you, and that's what people feed off of. That's what they enjoy, is the divide and conquer moment.
And I remember, just as an aside before you jump in here, Mike, is that when I first visited your young trade unionist meetings that you had on the east side, I was when it walked in, I was like, whoa, the multiracial nature of the crowd of young trade unionist organization in Baltimore, white, black, Latino, men, women, and the camaraderie, mixing up, sitting together, not sitting in separate places. That was a really, I was pleasantly surprised.
Because we all have... You have to find that common goal, and I think the workplace is definitely a common goal. We all want to be able to feed our families. We're looking for maybe 1 week vacation and to be able to send your kids to college. It's not much that you ask for, but those are just basics that anybody would want out of life, and you can corral around that common goal, and then you can build off of it. There's so many of my friends in the workplace that I hang out with to this day, whether it's just having fun type of thing. So it gets into something that's bigger, and it's – a great feeling, like I said.
Mike? Absolutely. I don't think there are many experiences that are as transformative as organizing, you know, as taking a group of people in a workplace, coming together, facing your own fears, confronting your boss. That is an experience that brings people together like few other experiences can. And I think it's got to be transformative for ourselves as individuals and for our unions as institutions. And we need to challenge ourselves as a labor movement to also see ourselves as part of the movement for racial justice. And I think that, you know, it applies to all the work that we do in coalitions with community groups. It applies to the way we take on fights in the workplace, where we see institutional racism in many different ways, that the union is a powerful tool to fight against. And I hope it's I hope that a deep commitment to anti-racism is part of the future of labor in Baltimore.
So would I say a collective sense, no pun intended, that in this room you feel positive about the future of labor in America?
I do.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, let me just say, well, a little of the Solidarity Forever is a good song to go out with. And I want to thank you all for being in this room. Have a happy Labor Day to everybody.
Appreciate you, Mark.
Appreciate all the workers coming in to have their conversation.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mike Hatchie, organizer for night here, Local 7, Jasmine Jones, who's organizing in that union as a union leader at Duke Law at the airport, Corey McCray, organizer for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, running for the House of Delegates
co-founder of Best Democratic Club and Young Trade Unionists. Bill Berry, retired director of labor studies at Community College of Baltimore, Baltimore County, and an author of three books. Thank you all three so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. To hear the show again and podcast any of our past shows and find out information about our guests, the work they do, what they've been writing, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving, mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.